Hello, I'm Justin Brierley, and welcome along. You found Unbelievable, and this is all you'll need for the next hour and a half as I guide you through another interesting discussion between a Christian and a non-Christian. Unbelievable, part of faith, explored every Saturday afternoon on Premier Christian Radio, the place where Christians and non-Christians get together for dialogue and debate. You can catch up on what's been happening recently on the programme by going to the website and downloading past programmes, going to the podcast, all that kind of thing. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. There's links there as well to features, articles, blogs, the Unbelievable DVD from last year, and more. Don't forget also, we'll be hearing some of your feedback to last week's programme later on in the show. Lots of feedback to the Mormon-Christian debate that we had last week, so look out for that as well. Coming up later on today on Premier Christian Radio, The Profile will feature two people. We'll be hearing firstly about the Connor Project, and then Loretta will be speaking to Simon May, who's the composer of the EastEnders theme tune, interestingly. So look out for that between 4 and 5. Right now, though, it's time for what I think is going to be a fabulous discussion on science and faith with two very eminent guests. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're asking, who invented the universe? Well, it's a play on the title of Alistair McGrath's new book called Inventing the Universe. Professor Alistair McGrath is Andreas Idrios Professor of Science and Religion at the University of Oxford. He's a theologian. He began his academic career as a scientist, however, and his new book, Inventing the Universe, traces his own journey from atheism to Christian faith and opens up some of the big questions about life, faith and meaning that scientific progress continues to raise. Really pleased to say that in discussion with Alistair today is Professor Jim Al-Khalili, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the University of Surrey. Well-known media figure, regularly presents the Radio 4 programme The Life Scientific. He's authored numerous books himself, most recently Life on the Edge, The Coming of Age of Quantum Biology. He's an atheist and the president of the British Humanist Association. This is going to be a great discussion. So welcome, gentlemen, both Alistair and Jim. Jim's joining us by phone from Surrey, where he's a professor of physics there. Alistair with me in the studio. Great to have you both with me on the programme today.
Hi. Great to be here.
Let's start with you, Alistair, as you've come in to talk about this new book. I've heard your story before, but it's nice to see it interwoven into some of these big questions that you draw out in this latest book, Inventing the Universe. Do you want, for the sake of those who perhaps aren't familiar with your story, just to give an idea of what your journey to faith involved? Because you were studying science, really, at the time you also
Yes, that's right. Well, let me tell it to you. Basically, when I was studying science at high school, I knew I was going to be a scientist. It's absolutely clear. But I was absolutely convinced that science eliminated any need for belief in God, that science, if you like, gobbled up the conceptual space that God once occupied. And I became, I'm afraid, quite aggressive as an atheist. I wouldn't for one moment say all atheists are like that, but I became extremely aggressive, that someone who believed in God was mad, bad, or sad. And I found myself thinking myself intellectually above all that sort of stuff. But I think I have to say to you that in studying sciences, one thing I did not study was the history and philosophy of science. And when I won my scholarship to Oxford to study chemistry, I found myself with 6 months on my hands to wait before going from school to university. And I used that time to bring myself up to speed with some things, including reading about the history and philosophy of science. And I have to say that really opened my eyes to a lot of questions I just had not thought about before. Masses, issues of the undetermination of theories by evidence, a whole series of things like that. And it didn't bring me to religious faith or anything like that, but it did, I think, put a very big question mark against what I think I would have to say were very simplistic understanding of what science was. But it suddenly made me aware that there was a bigger universe than I had imagined, and that science actually was not quite as straightforward as I had thought. I then went to Oxford to study chemistry, and during my time there, I began to rethink things. And to cut a long story short, I left behind my atheism and embraced Christianity, I think primarily because I felt this gave me a much better way of seeing things. And then went on to do biological research with Professor George Rader, and then switched to theology, because I was so interested in this question, you know, how does science and faith, how do they hold together, if at all? And I wanted to get intellectual resolution of that. Now, I want to make it clear, I mean, okay, I moved from atheism to Christianity, but there's no way I'm going to say atheists are idiots. I mean, that's childish. It's simply nonsense. It's insulting. But I do believe Christianity offers a better perspective, and I think that's something I really do want to explore in the book.
In the book about the idea of it being like putting on a different set of glasses and seeing the world through a different lens. a theistic lens or an atheistic lens. Is it as simple as that, sort of just, as it were, changing your perspective? I mean, a lot of people would say, well, it must be about finding what's really true, you know, rather than just changing your perspective in that sense.
Well, nothing's simple, but this is just a very easy-to-understand metaphor for trying to understand what's happening. And it has a long history in the philosophy of science, you know, a theory-driven set of spectacles. You see it this way, you put on a different set of spectacles, see it that way. Which way of looking at it seems to give you a better grasp of the evidence that's available. And so I think it's a good metaphor for understanding at least part of this. We see things in different ways. And one of the questions is, what is the best way of seeing things? Indeed, the Greek word theoria, from which we get our English word theory, really means a manner of beholding. In other words, this is a way of looking at things. And the question that really we have to face is, what is the best way of looking at things? And also, is there simply one way of looking at things universally, or is there one way of looking at things for science, one for religion? And in fact, might there even be multiple ways of looking at things within science itself, which is a view I think is very defensible.
Well, we're going to get into some of the questions that are raised, and it's quite wide-ranging, the book, in terms of the areas that you tackle. So we'll see where we get to as we continue a conversation today with Professor Jim Al-Khalili. We're going on first-name terms today, though, so I'll address you as Jim from here on in.
Absolutely fine.
Jim, you've really become quite a high-profile figure in many ways. You work regularly on radio, TV, and so on. In fact, my wife was very excited to hear that you were coming on this programme. She listens to The Life Scientific herself, and I said, don't you listen to my radio show, darling? But apparently, no, it's Jim Al-Khalili's show that she's more likely to tune into. But
I have to tell you, my wife has also is guilty of that. I remember a couple of years ago walking in at home after for dinner, and she said, oh, here comes my second favourite TV. that Cox chap, you know.
Well,
we're all in competition.
Well, who can live up to Brian Cox anyway? But anyway, it's great to have you on. Obviously, you are an atheist. I read even that you once said that despite being the son of a Protestant Christian mother and a Shia Muslim father, I've nevertheless ended up without a religious bone in my body. So did your atheism grow up naturally alongside your interest in science? What was the story?
Yes, it's difficult to disentangle, really. I guess partly so, yes. For me, my study of science and trying to find a non-theistic answer to the questions of how the universe is the way it is and our place in it, my scientific training did probably push me away from a religious faith. But then there is that inevitable, you know, have I fallen between two stools? You know, I grew up, my mother sadly passed away recently, but you know, her faith was very important to her, and certainly towards the end it was. She's a born-again evangelical Christian. My father is a Shia Muslim, and I grew up in a household where there was never any conflict between the two. You know, there wasn't any sort of pulling from different directions. We grew up learning that Allah was Arabic for God, and that the Abrahamic religions were pretty much, you know, different cultural ways of different times of reaching the same conclusion. So right. There was never any conflict. But I guess probably I was in my teens when I decided that those weren't the answers that I was looking for, and moved away from theistic religious faith.
Has your science, as it's progressed, sort of at any level confirmed that view of the world, or is it something separate? You know, do you?
It probably has. I mean, it depends. Of course, you know, different areas of science. If you're an engineer or a laser physicist, or you can be working in science and have it not butt up against, you know, issues, theological issues that you then have to grapple with and reconcile with your science. But for me, because you know, theoretical physics and thinking about the origins of the universe and the fundamental building blocks of everything, for me, in a sense, I think it has cemented it. It's made me more comfortable.
Yeah.
That I don't need any more, you know, a supernatural explanation for the way things are the way they are.
Sure. Well, we're going to pursue this and see where it leads us in different directions in the course of today's programme. Really pleased to have two such guests with me today, Jim and Alistair. Jim Al-Khalili, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the University of Surrey, well known as well on radio, presents The Life Scientific on Radio 4, and President of the British Humanist Association. Alistair McGrath is with me too. He's a theologian, began his career as a scientist, but now tends to write on the intersection between science and faith. And that's certainly what his latest book is about, Inventing the Universe, published by Hodder. And we're going to continue today's programme. If you'd like to get in touch about anything you hear, we'd love to hear from you too. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook too, if you'd like to follow us there. @unbelievablejb is the place to go on Twitter. facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page. All of those links available and much more as well from the webpage of the show, where you can find today's programme and leave a comment too. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Just as we start to dig into this then, and this is something you tackle in the book, Alistair, the question of whether science is atheistic in some sense. I think you do get that impression from some people in the scientific world that there's somehow science is by its nature atheistic because it excludes, as sort of Jim was saying, the need for supernatural explanations. But what's your approach to how we should view science?
Well, science is science, full stop. And it starts going wrong when it gets entangled with religion or with anti-religion or politics or social movements, you know. In fact, for me, the success and the joy of science is that it is above all this stuff. And I remember very well some words that Thomas Huxley once spoke at a lecture in London celebrating Darwin. He said, look, science commits suicide when it adopts a creed. And I think he's absolutely right that the distinctive thing about science is it's above this.
And the creed could be both religious or anti-religious.
Or political. I mean, look what happened in the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. But I think that the key point I'd like to make is this. I mean, science, if you had to describe its methodology, and that's a hard thing to do, but in general terms, it is, in effect, a kind of methodological naturalism, that we proceed on the assumption that we are investigating nature on its own terms and we don't involve anything beyond it. But that's a methodology. It's not an ontology. It's, in effect, saying, look, this is our research method. By definition, a research method can uncover some things and not others, and this is the research method that science uses. But we have to be very careful we don't conflate that into a view of reality. It leaves open a whole range of options. So I would be very suspicious of those who said that science is necessarily or intrinsically atheist. I think what you could say is that science just doesn't do that sort of stuff. That in fact, that this all lies beyond the scope of the scientific method. And for me, it leaves open a whole range of questions. That's why it's so interesting to explore the interface of science and other things. Because if you want to put a sort of visual image, I mean, there's a big picture of reality. Maybe science illuminates part of that picture. But for me, one of the big issues is this. I mean, every scientist I know is a human being. And human beings really need more than just an understanding of how the world functions. They need something about meaning and value and so on. And Jim and I, I'm sure, have interesting conversation about this, but it seems to me that science doesn't do meaning. I mean, not least because it's a difficult question, but also because I think it has the tools to do it. And so for me, that opens up a very interesting conversation between science and other things about how we can amplify a scientific vision of reality without making science into something that is not science.
Yeah, something it wasn't meant to be used for. Jim, do you agree with Alistair there, or do you think that science does in some sense tend towards an atheistic view of the world?
I think, you know, I don't want to be in danger of agreeing too much with that stuff. But of course, he's right. You know, science is a method. It's a way of learning about the world, about the universe, that requires, you know, putting up a hypothesis, a theory that is then tested against empirical observations or data, that it has to be reproducible, and so on. So it's a way of learning about the world. In that sense, it shines a light on the universe, and there are other ways of shining light on meaning and so on. I guess where we will differ is that, as I said, about science doesn't offer meaning or motive. Is that right?
Is that what you're saying, that we shouldn't look to science for meaning, Alistair?
Meaning, precisely because it's a non-empirical idea. I can't see meaning. What you can do is you can infer what meaning might be, but then how would you verify it? So really, it's to do with this whole question of whether meaning is something we can read off, or whether we have to, if I can use the simple word, invent it.
Yes, absolutely. I agree entirely. A few years ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury. Mm. I have this series of events here at Surrey called Jim Meets, and he happened to be visiting Guildford Cathedral, and we sort of nabbed him to come and chat to me in front of a live audience, and we had this sort of discussion, and I think this is where sort of the crux of the difference is that. If you have a religious faith, a belief in something over and above just what you can observe empirically or determine scientifically, that's because you're looking for meaning. And I guess the difference is that, for me, I don't see the need to find meaning. That the universe is the way it is, and we try and understand the workings of those universe, but I don't see why we have to find a deeper purpose to it all. Mm. And I think that ultimately that may well be the difference, between a theist and an atheist. That an atheist is perfectly comfortable and satisfied that there is nothing beyond what.
But you must have some concept in which you do think of meaning. In your own life, but is that something that's?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. In terms of the way motives and emotions and anything that the complexity of the human being, everything we do. So that's just the nature of Homo sapiens, that we look for meaning in things and try to understand each other's actions.
But is that you? I mean, you use a scientific term there, Homo sapiens, to describe yourself. Do you believe that the things you think of as giving meaning to your life, your motives, values and so on, are ultimately reducible to scientific explanations for those things?
Well, yes, because I don't require meaning to be ascribed to some higher entity or higher power. For me, it has to be derived from the complexity of the human mind. We create our own meaning, we create our own motives and desires and emotions, but it's all embedded within the mind. Now, whether science is able to answer all those questions and is a complete different point, I guess. It's very true that, there's certain, any scientist worth their salt would have to admit that question is beyond the remit of science. So science doesn't, at the moment, give us all the answers. But that doesn't mean that there is something over and above what we can rationally understand.
Alistair?
Well, I think I respond very positively to what Jim is saying. I used to think that myself. I can understand entirely. And I think, again, if I misunderstood Jim, I do apologise. But I think what Jim was saying is that in his personal life, he constructs or he develops meaning which he believes for good reasons to be right, but doesn't actually necessarily think science would feed into that. I think what I'd want to begin to explore is where that meaning comes from, or if we could make this a bigger question, where value comes from. Because if you take a classic issue in the whole history of ideas, if you look at, for example, Sir Isaiah Berlin's very interesting study of 20th century European thought, one of the points he makes is, look, there are certain things you can show by logic, certain things you can show by science, and then there's a whole realm of stuff you can't prove either of these ways. And when you start looking at what's in that third category, it is all political, ethical, social, religious, anti-religious views. And his key point is, look, these are so radically underdetermined by evidence that actually, if you say, I only believe what can be proved, you've got to rule all of these out. And his point is that actually, as human beings, this is the sort of stuff we believe. And I think it's very interesting, because I think what Jim and I might be able to discuss is if we cannot prove certain things to be true, but nevertheless feel that we need certain ideas of meaning or value to live out meaningful lives, how do we cope with the possible cognitive dissonance between holding certain things to be true and yet feeling that we can't actually clinch it and can't actually show these things are right, even though they are helpful to us in living our life.
Do you just have to accept a certain level of mystery as an atheist in that sense, Jim?
Absolutely, because, you know, science doesn't have all the answers, nor is it likely to have all the answers. Yes, there is going to be mystery. There is going to be something that is beyond our grasp. But that we, you know, whether it's our what we would call a conscience or a moral compass, or simply the way, you know, interrelationships between people, as I said, you know, things like politics and philosophy and ethics and so on, you can't find some sort of formula for it to explain it. And it may well be beyond just simple complexity that science hasn't arrived yet to answer those questions. We may never be able to. But I would argue, though, that that is still something that comes out of the complexity of the wonder.
Yes,
of the human
mind. You don't feel you have to go beyond what we know of the mind to explain the meaning.
That's right. I mean, I tend to, you know, I think probably one of the reasons why I was asked to be president of the British Humanist Association was that it was felt that I wouldn't, you know, in the same way that Alistair wouldn't call atheists stupid, I would never call a theist or someone with a religious faith stupid, because, you know, that's naive and simplistic. And obviously, if the debate and discussion we're having now were resolvable, it would have been
I'd be out of a job, frankly.
But one thing I do take issue with very often with people of religious faith is to say that because you need religion to provide meaning, to provide the moral compass, then somehow if you don't, if you're an atheist, you don't have that moral compass. And for me as a humanist, I will say, well, that, you know, the Ten Commandments and or the teachings of the Abrahamic religions, and indeed many of the world's religions, the stuff about, you know, be nice to each other and how to live and how to interact, for me that is what defines our humanity, and that has been encoded in holy books and scriptures. But it wasn't, you know, we would have it, I would
it's a human thing that. Not a religious
yeah.
thing
See, yeah. we would have it yeah. even if there were yeah. no religion.
Well, I mean, extending this, I know that you did write a little bit of the book on the concept of humanism per se, Alistair. I feel like that kind of ties into what Jim's saying here. In fact, you said in a heading in that chapter, humanism needs to find a new name for itself. It's a bit of a challenge, as you've got the president of the British Humanist Association on the line.
Yeah, but, well, you know, I probably wouldn't disagree.
Well, let me make some suggestions at the moment. But if I can come in here, I think this is a great conversation. I really, really love where it's going. I think one thing I want to say, Jim, is, look, I would never say, look, you have to be religious to be moral. What I would say, though, and this is something we perhaps might talk about a little bit later in the conversation, is, how do you stabilize those moral notions? How do you, in effect, say this is grounded in something deeper merely than me thinking or saying this? And for me, one of the things that belief in God does is to stabilize that notion of good. Now, I mean, you might say, well, look, a philosopher like Iris Murdoch does something much along the same lines. But I think the issue is whether we simply see our thinking about goodness as reflecting what we personally think, or whether there's something beyond us that does it. But let's go back to this question that you raised, which is, does humanism need to find a new name for itself? And I think this is a very interesting topic. I would describe myself as a Christian humanist, rather like Erasmus of Rotterdam or someone like that, where, you know, it is about human fulfillment. We need to be what we're meant to be. And for me, that's all about, you know, relating to God. That makes us, that gives us excitement, it gives us a moral compass, it gives us a sense of identity and meaning. I know Jim won't agree with this, but you know, that, I'm just saying that's my perspective.
Yeah, sure.
And for me, it's not because God is kind of way banging on me or anything like that. It's much more because this is what humanity
was created for.
Well, that's right. Yeah. This is what it's all about. Now, humanism, that simple word as such, is now used to mean an anti-religious viewpoint. Now, I wonder if Jim would be open to discussing whether the word, well, would phrase secular humanism be better to describe what the British Human Association is all about? Because it seems to me that because there are multiple definitions and understandings of what human being is all about, there must be multiple understandings of humanism as well. It seems to me there's a need for the recognition of a pluralism of possibilities here. And I'd like to know what Jim thinks about that.
I have to say I agree. I think a lot of people in certainly in the British humanist movement do refer to it as secular humanism. I mean, I agree. You know, a few hundred years ago, a humanist didn't mean at all that you had to not have a religious faith. Christian humanism existed, but presumably the British Humanist Association now would exclude someone who would define themselves as a Christian humanist. So secular humanism is a much more honest description of what the humanist movement currently stands for. Student societies around the country, there's the AHS, the Atheist Humanist Secular Society, which is an honest and complete definition of where they stand.
Sure. I think
just to say humanist is not enough. And indeed to say somehow humanist, I think the other danger is that it can be seen as elevating humans above where they are within life on Earth, that somehow we are special. And yet at the same time, as a scientist, I'm aware that humans are just, we're sort of evolved apes. You know, Darwinian evolution says that that our genetic difference between us and the other great apes is tiny. There isn't that magical, line that, which a lot of Muslims I talk to would still argue. Yes, Darwinian evolution is fine, but, stop before you get to humans. And humanism somehow, I think, elevates us into that special category which really shouldn't exist.
But then again, the secular organisation for advanced conscious beings doesn't quite have the same ring, I suppose.
No, quite. But, no, exactly. It has to be snappy. That's
it's fun. Look, we're going to take a quick break and we'll come back for more conversation. Perhaps we'll move into the realm of physics and the universe as well in the next part of the discussion today. Really enjoying today's conversation between Professor Alistair McGrath. His new book is called Inventing the Universe, published by Hodder, and he's in a conversation with Professor Jim Al-Khalili, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the University of Surrey and well-known in the media, presents the Radio 4 programme The Life Scientific. Come back again in a short moment's time for Unbelievable, the programme that aims to get you thinking.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone.
The date was October 1965. The trousers were flared, the skirts were mini, and an unusual magazine was about to launch. Buzz connected young Christians to contemporary culture and music. Well, 50 years on, and today called Premier Christianity, this month we're celebrating half a century of connecting faith, church, and culture. Why not read the story for yourself and request a free copy of our beautiful golden 50-year anniversary edition by visiting premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the show that, as I say, aims to get you thinking every Saturday as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. Don't forget you can download today's programme online. In fact, thousands of people listen every week via the podcast. Why not join them if you don't already? That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for links to where you can find out more about the show, past episodes. Leave your comments there. Find us on Facebook, Twitter and so on. We'll be hearing some of your responses by email later on in the show to some previous editions of the programme, and we'll be finding out what you thought about some of the other guests we've had on in recent episodes. If you want to get in touch about today's show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is a good way to do that, and I like to read emails from new listeners to the show. Tell me where you're emailing from as well, what part of the world you live in. We're also going to be finding out later on what's going on around the world in terms of some of the events and things coming up that may be of interest to you as well. Today on the show, though, Professor Alistair McGrath is with me. His new book is called Inventing the Universe. Alistair is a theologian who began his academic career as a scientist, and this new book traces his own journey from atheism to Christian faith and opens up some of the big questions about life, faith and meaning that scientific progress continues to raise. And in this part of the programme, we'll hopefully look into some of those questions around physics. And to help us do that, Professor Jim Al-Khalili on the line from the University of Surrey, where he's Professor of Theoretical Physics. He's also well-known in the media, presents the Radio 4 programme, The Life Scientific, and of course is President of the British Humanist Association. And it would be fun to to get back to that conversation on meaning that we were having in the last section. But let's talk about physics, because this is your area of speciality in that sense, Jim. Now, it's often been said, and I've hosted numerous editions of this programme, where some Christians, some scientists, some theologians want to use some of the latest scientific advancements to make a case for design or for God. For instance, fine-tuning. So this is, if I can try and summarise it, is talking about the fact that at the very genesis of the universe, the fundamental constants and forces of nature appear to be finely tuned to allow the existence of life at some point in its later history. It could have been otherwise. The universe could have expanded too fast and not been able to support any planets or solar systems. It could have collapsed back in on itself and so on. You know, you have to have these incredibly apparently finely tuned things like the gravitational force constant, the number of electrons and ratio of electrons to protons in the universe, all sorts of these sorts of things have been suggested that this couldn't have arisen by chance. Must be the only viable explanation is that there's some kind of designing hand behind it all. Okay, Jim, where do you go with these kinds of, if you like, let's say, religious conclusions that stem from scientific evidence?
Yes, I think this is a powerful argument against the idea that our universe just arose for no reason, and here we are contemplating it. Mm. And yet, as you say, if you work back and calculate just how unlikely it is that we are here to contemplate the universe, as you say, you know, any tiny tweak in any of the constants of nature, the speed of light, the charge of the electron, not, you know, how life began on Earth, because we're now discovering billions of other stars that have planets around them, many of which might have the right conditions, you know, might have just the right temperature and have water and have carbon and so on. And so, you know, life, there could be life elsewhere in the universe. So maybe we're not so special. But that ultimate question of how come our universe it has just the right properties, like, you know, the Goldilocks and the Bears and the porridge being just right. It is an issue. I mean, I don't know whether it's the favorite explanation, but many cosmologists now favor the theory, and in a sense, it's not really a scientific theory because we don't know how to test it experimentally, so it's not a real theory. But that is that our universe, just like our planet is not the only one that could harbor life, our universe is not the only one. And modern ideas in cosmology suggest that our universe, the Big Bang that created our space-time, is just one of a possible infinite number of Big Bangs creating other universes, many of which didn't have, you know, gravity was too strong, or you know, they didn't have the speed of light was too slow or whatever, and just fizzled out again. And so we are the lottery.
Yes, you're effectively cutting the odds by increasing the number of possible universes.
You know, so the winner of the lottery says, "Yeah, but how can I possibly win?" Well, someone has to.
Yeah,
and so that is an argument. For me, you know, I don't know if that's the correct answer, but it's no worse than saying there has to be a design that tweaked our universe. There was, because for me the issue of design just opens up
talk to me about that a bit before Alistair comes in, because in a sense, you know, I sometimes have Christians and atheists on this show discussing this issue, and the point comes up from the Christian that well, look, God, or a design at least, is just as valid an explanation as your also untested theory of a multiple universes and so on. Why does science sort of somehow mean we can't allow the design option a foot in the door? Why does science militate against that in any way? Is it an assumption that we have to make for some reason?
It's an assumption, but it's Occam's razor. I mean, the simplest explanation would be that our universe is not unique. There are multiple other universes, and we just happen to be in the right one with the right conditions. Whereas to postulate a designer, then by definition, that designer must be more complex than the universe around us.
That's the thing that Richard Dawkins has argued.
That's right. Yeah. You know, and I think many atheists argue that you know, if we are looking for an explanation for the complexity and beauty of our universe, then why postulate something more complex, more beautiful in order to explain this. You just push the argument, not only push the argument one step back, but make it even more insurmountable.
Okay. Alistair?
Well, lots of interesting things to talk about there. I mean, I'm very interested in this multiverse theory, although it does seem to me to be a theoretical entailment rather than something we observe. And I think that, you know, there's always this issue of what happens if theory change happens. And that's a very interesting thing. And I do agree with Jim. I think that there are some very interesting questions here where we do run the risk of pressing things too far. And there is the question of the evidential foundations of this. I mean, I often tease my physicist friends about string theory and just ask them why I should believe that. And the answer tends to be, well, look, if it is right, it helps us to understand, but don't ask us why it is right. But, of course, I'm just being naughty there. I think this point about complexity is really interesting. I mean, Richard Dawkins does argue that a complex universe would require an even more complex God, although my philosopher friends, I have to say, grade that argument very, very lowly. That they say that in effect, that there is no reason to, in effect, imply you have a complex God to have a complex universe. I think that does need further discussion. But I think that the main point Jim's raising is a good one, which is what's the simplest explanation?
Yeah.
And the first point I want to make is, you know, it was years ago when I watched Richard Feynman's Lectures in Physical Theory. It's one of these things that you did when you were in the sixth form in my days. And I do remember him saying that we're all taught that the simplest theory is the right theory. And he just gave lots of his counterexamples, said, look, it wasn't that straightforward. And I do want to hold to that sometimes we need to be cautious about that. But even so, I mean, as a Christian, I'm not saying, you know, the complexity, the fine-tuning of the universe demands belief in God. It's much more an inductive approach, which is saying, look, here's what Christianity says. Now, there's the way the universe is. If you're a Christian, just look at it and say, that makes sense. You know, it's this almost...
It fits.
It fits. It's the kind of C.S. Lewis type approach. Lewis, you may remember those very famous words, says, I'm an empirical theist. I arrived at belief in God by induction. And it was this issue of, you know, in effect, here's this theoretical spectacle, here's that theoretical spectacle. Oh, look, this one seems to see things more clearly. And I think it's that kind of argument. It's not deductive. It's not saying this necessarily points you in this direction. It's this seems to help make sense of things. And you know, if you look at the philosophy of theory validation, you know, I mean, very often you find yourself in a situation where you have multiple possible explanations of a phenomenon and you have multiple criteria for evaluating. And it's actually very, very difficult. Simplicity is in there, but it's only part of the mix, I'm afraid. And there is this debate about what are the best criteria by which a theory might be judged. And certainly simplicity might be one, but so might comprehensiveness, so might fecundity and so on. And it's very hard to judge these. My perception, which I fully understand I cannot prove by universally demonstrable criteria, is that if you believe in God like a Christian God, in effect, you look at things and say, that makes sense to me. It's more an act of imagination where you can see the whole thing fitting together than
and you're rational saying, demonstration. You're saying that the universe as you see it fits better with a theistic view where there is a God than an atheistic view where there is not a God. It's that you wouldn't have the same kind of inductive sense that would lead you towards an atheistic
outcome. Well, that's part of it, though I think that's a bit of a simplification. Mm. But there is a good point there. I mean... you know this famous argument for the proof of God. You know this is moving; it's moved by something else, and so on. And you come back to a prime unmoved mover. People say, "Hey, why are you just arbitrarily terminating the explanatory process?"
Yeah.
But what I want to know is, look, we have a singular event we call the Big Bang. We can't actually go beyond it. Either you say this happened by forces and means we don't really fully understand, or maybe there might be something behind us which kicked the whole thing off. And it just seems to me we need to be awfully cautious here about, in effect, excessively theory-driven approaches which are, in effect, compromised by theoretical commitments which actually aren't absolutely secure.
Jim, any thoughts on this?
No, absolutely. This is very interesting. I mean, I certainly agree that, as Paul Dirac, famous physicist, said, if the experiment doesn't match his theory, then go away and redo your experiment because his theory is too beautiful. So that is not a good criterion for seeking understanding and truth about the universe, that a theory is beautiful, nor indeed because it's simple. But I would argue that nor is because it makes sense. It would be nice. You want this within our human nature to want to look out and understand the universe and feel it makes sense, and that makes us feel comfortable and that we're on the right tracks. But hey, you know, I've spent 30 years trying to make sense of quantum mechanics, and that's, I'm not sure Alistair knows, it's utterly counterintuitive. So if I went on the criterion that it makes sense, then I would probably arrive at the wrong explanation for how atoms behave, for example. So wanting something to make sense, I understand, but saying because it makes sense, therefore that is a better way of knowing how the universe is and why it is, isn't satisfying for me.
Well, I mean, Alistair, though, says he has this inductive process that lends support to his view that there is a God, because, you know, he looks at the universe and he says it fits. Do you look at the universe and equally have an inductive sense that it fits with the view that there is no God?
I'm not sure I do that. I guess if, you know, many atheists will equally have a set of, you know, as Alistair mentioned, this, you know, the proof that there is no God, that there are logical steps that one can follow in diametrically opposite directions and arrive at something that you feel is your destination. I don't do that. I try and understand the universe. I mean, listen, I don't want to big myself up, though. I'm the world's deepest thinker, and I'm exploring. Yeah, I'm trying to understand my little bit,
yes,
within theoretical physics. But for me, I guess everything I've done and everything I've learnt about the laws of physics and the properties of the universe haven't required me or haven't left that gap within me that I need to fill with something other, something higher, which is, I guess, what you know, Alistair did probably feel when he was an atheist, but there was then a need to there was a gap. I mean, I guess you found a gap, and you might argue I haven't yet found it. I would argue that I...
But are you saying that what Alistair's approach boils down to is the so-called God of the gaps, i.e. the, you know, he can't explain why he has this sense of ultimate meaning. He can't explain where the universe came from. He's going to insert God into that gap.
I give Alistair a bit more credit. You know, science has all the answers, and where science hasn't quite got there yet, we'll put God in as a temporary stopgap until science can smooth things over, and there'll be a continuous explanation all the way to the Big Bang. No, I'm sure that's not it. But it's this. Yes, deductively finding reaching a point where you say it really makes much more sense, and it's a much clearer, in focus image that I get of reality when there is a God, a designer behind it. I guess for me, it's something that, you know, you can't argue for or against, which is why these sort of discussions ultimately are somewhat. Unsatisfying.
Mm.
We're not going to arrive at there. Gotcha. You know.
Yeah. No. No. I think Alice is interested in coming back on.
No, I think Jim's, you know, really put his finger on something there. That I mean, one of the great things about science is it really does challenge the ultimacy of human reason. I think that's a very important point. How on earth can we tiny little things with very finite brains make sense of this thing? And I know Jim wants to just put some scare quotes around make sense of. I don't mean it. But nevertheless, I mean, going back to quantum theory, when I start studying that, you know, oh my God, I mean, I just thought this is mad. You know, and eventually I got my head around it. And the astonishing thing was, once you got your head around it and conformed to a different rationality, actually it did make sense. And it made sense in itself, and it made sense of the world. It's that thing that Jim knows all about, Eugene Wigner's famous article, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. Mm. Why is it this works? And he has a lovely line, I think it's about a third the way through the article, where he says, you know, we need some big theory, some big picture to help make sense of why mathematics can do this. And that's why, I mean, Jim's right, I mean, this God of the Gap stuff, I just have no time for it. But nevertheless, we are looking for a big picture that makes sense of the success of science, the ability of mathematics to represent it. I mean, it's a very interesting question. Why is mathematics, which is supposedly the free creation of the human mind, able to represent things so well? Now, again, I know Jim's going to disagree, but for me, you know, it's this sort of Christian framework gives you that. I know that doesn't prove a thing, but it is, I think, very significant. I mean, you think Johann Kepler's very famous talk about language, the universe being written in, the, in mathematics, which is the language of God sort of stuff. But it is very interesting. And for me, actually, these questions are ongoing. You can't shut them down because these are big issues, big questions. And as this conversation is showing, they are fascinating.
Is it your view then, Alistair, that you find it harder to believe that the rational intelligibility of the universe, the way mathematics maps onto our experience of the universe, it's harder to believe that that's just a fluke than to believe that it somehow ties into some bigger picture which involves a creator behind it ultimately?
If it's a fluke, it's a very nice fluke. But I mean, I can understand, if you take a Darwinian view, I can understand why basic mathematics might be helpful. You know, there are six predators there, there's one predator there, I'm going that way. You know, that's mathematics is very basic. But, you know, Newtonian calculus, I mean,
It's there waiting to be discovered.
And very often you find there's a mathematical discovery and everyone says that's useless, and then 200 years later it turns out to be useful. And I think it's astonishing. Now, again, one of the things for me as a Christian, I just take intellectual delight in this because, A, it's wonderful in itself, but, B, it does fit in so well with if you read Thomas Aquinas, if you read even St. Paul, you find some of the ideas there which really resonate so well. So for me, I want to believe this. It's actually, I find myself compelled to believe this because it's so good.
What's your view, Jim, when it comes to that mapping out of the universe in mathematical terms? Did we invent that, or was that already invented and waiting to be discovered? What's your view?
I have no idea. I mean, absolutely, this is a huge philosophical question. You know, why does nature speak the language of mathematics? We've invented, say, these techniques, calculus and others, and it seems that using this language, we're able to learn more about the laws of nature. But whether in some sort of Platonic universe the mathematics exists already and it was floating out there, you know, pi and simultaneous equations, and you know, we've figured out, we've unlocked that secret that was already there and used it to learn news, or whether we created it to understand news, I have no idea. I mean,
don't you sort of have to assume something, though? I guess what I'm pushing you towards, Jim, is does your atheism require, at some level, that the fluke option or the it just is option kind of is the option you have to go for on that basis?
For me, not having an answer, not knowing. It's fine.
Okay.
You know, I would like to think I will reach the answers, whether I will turn to religion later in life, or whether I have some epiphany, or whether there will be some clever genius who will, you know.
If you could do that by the end of the show, that would be fantastic.
I think maybe it comes down to what we as humans expect in terms of how much we want to understand. You know, I'm happy for there still to be mysteries out there. I'm happy to not understand but to try, rather than say. I've heard it said. I've heard other atheists say, "Yeah, well, you know, religious faith is just intellectually lazy because you say, well, I can't explain this. Oh, well, it must be God."
I had one of them on recently.
Well, okay. Well, no, I'm not going to fall into that silly trap. I'm envious. I think, I guess, is probably the right word to say of Alistair, that it gives you meaning, that you know you feel comfortable that things fall into place with your faith. Whereas for me, I'm still grasping, I'm still reaching, trying to find out. But I'm envious, you know, of your sort of. But I'm nevertheless at peace with not knowing, if you know what I mean.
Any responses on that, Alison?
Well, I think Jim has put his finger on something very important, which is we live with unresolved questions. And that's why, I mean, I do really object to religious people who say this is the way it is and that's it, or indeed on the other side, if you like, I'll mention their names, but there are people who in effect imply that everything is shut down and there's no room for discussion and there are only idiots who raise these questions. Reality is complicated. For me, the really big question is this, and it's come out from what Jim's been saying. Is, in the end, science simply the uncovering of the way the universe works and that's it? Mm-hmm. Or does our attempt to uncover the way the universe works give us insights at a deeper level into something that might actually transcend the universe? And I'm not talking about God as a kind of inhabitant of the universe, a sort of mythical teapot orbiting Mars or Jupiter or something stupid. But it's that thing that William Inge, Dean St. Paul's, talked about in 1917, where he said, look, rationalism tries to fit God into its picture of the universe, but actually God is rather the canvas on which the universe is painted, the frame which contains it. And it's that big issue. Is there a transcendence beyond the observable which can in some way be known? And if so, does it give meaning, purpose, value, and animation? And Jim's very kind to speak of me as a settled person. I think that's very nice. I haven't heard that before, and I like that very much. But actually, I'm restless because, you know, I want to keep checking. I want to think further. But I think that's really one of the big questions. I think Jim and I agree a lot on what science is all about. The big question really is whether science points beyond itself to something bigger, which helps us understand science, or whether we can treat science, in effect, as self-contained and be happy about that.
Well, I mean, one thing that sometimes atheists say, I don't know if Jim agrees or not, is that religion is a science stopper, because it sort of says, I've reached an explanation, it's God, I don't have to look any more into science and so on. Whereas you're saying, no, you're a Christian, Alistair, but you're still restless. You still presumably don't believe that your Christian faith stops you having to go any further, because that's explained everything.
Yeah, look, my Christian faith gives me a map. Does that stop me exploring the territory the map's of? No, no. It means that I explore the territory and the map becomes even more meaningful.
Right. Just as we close out this section of the programme, Jim, any response there? And I don't know, do you feel that you could ever, I don't know, find out enough about the universe that was mysterious enough to point you in the direction of something beyond it, the canvas that it might be painted upon, let's say?
Well, I mean, all I can say is that, you know, science's record so far is, you know, so far so good. You know, all the way from Copernicus and Galileo saying, no, actually, the Earth goes around the Sun, not the other way around. You know, Newton and using calculus to explain the forces through to Darwin and Einstein. Science hasn't got all the answers, but its success so far would suggest to me that we can carry on using science to learn more. Now, whether we'll ultimately uncover a deeper meaning is something that no one knows, but I'm not looking that far.
I think Alistair's saying it already is uncovering some kind of deeper meanings. I think Alistair is going as far as to say,
right, okay,
it's giving us hints. See, I don't at the very
see
least.
That. Mm. Yeah, I don't see that deeper meaning. I see beauty and complexity and wonder in the universe, but it's something that the rationalism of the scientific method is still explaining, despite not having reached any ultimate answers yet.
Do you want to quickly come back on that, Alistair, and we'll go to our break?
I think science is wonderful. It progresses, but progresses by making mistakes. I think we just need to be clear. It's not a uniform, linear progression. You know, we've made mistakes. 1906, that book by Arrhenius, you know, the universe has always been here the way it is, just local redistribution of energy. We've given up on that one. What's so great about science is that when it makes mistakes, it corrects them. And I think that you know, we always have to check out as to whether what we are saying today is the way it is, is simply the way we see it today, which will be corrected by future generations. That issue that Michael Polanyi talks about in his book Personal Knowledge, he says, look, the dilemma of the scientists is, I believe these things to be true, but actually I'm aware a future generation will show I'm wrong on several of them. But that doesn't mean science is wrong at all. It just means we need to be very careful about linear progression. It's much more complex than that.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back just for a final summing up with my guests today on Unbelievable. They are Alistair McGrath. He's a theologian who began his academic career as a scientist. His new book, Inventing the Universe, is out now, published by Hodder. Professor Jim Al-Khalili joins us down the line from the University of Surrey, where he's Professor of Theoretical Physics. And he's also the host, of course, of Radio 4's programme, The Life Scientific, has authored numerous books himself. And we'll make sure there's links to both my guests from today's episode online. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable for more about today's show. And we'll be back in a moment's time to wrap up our discussion.
Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable programme with me, Justin Brierley, part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon, the time of the week on Premier, when we help you to think through your faith in all kinds of different ways. And if you're not a believer, perhaps you listen to the programme via podcast, you're equally welcome along. It's great to have all the different kinds of interactions we have. We'll be hearing from some of you later on and what you had to say about last week's programme. If you're able to keep listening after Unbelievable between 4 and 5, you can find out about the Connor Project and Loretta speaking to Simon May, the composer of the EastEnders theme tune, among other things, about his Christian faith journey. So look out for that as well. Don't forget that past programmes from Unbelievable are always available from the website, and there's links there to where you can subscribe on iTunes via other podcasting software, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And we try to keep you updated with what's going on as well on the Unbelievable Facebook page and Twitter account at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievableJB. And I regularly post interesting articles and things like that. One of the things I posted actually this last week was what's become a popular article actually on the Premier Christianity blog. I'm the editor of Premier Christianity magazine. And on our blog this week, we opened up the faith of the new Liverpool Football Club manager, Jurgen Klopp. He's a very committed Christian, it turns out, and he had some interesting things to say about his Christian faith. So if you want to find out more about that, perhaps you're a football fan and would like to know more about what Jurgen Klopp has to say about his Christian faith, then go to premierchristianity.com/blog. And I'll be letting you know a little bit more about the 50-year history of the magazine later on in amongst the feedback section. So lots to look forward to a little later on in the programme. Next week on the show, we're going to be returning to the issue of the resurrection. We'll be hearing an overdue debate, actually, between Ed Atkinson, a former Christian, who's going to be in discussion with Tony Costa, who's a Christian evangelist and apologist on the resurrection. So look out for that at the same time next week. For now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion between my guests, Alistair and Jim.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
I've really enjoyed today's interaction between Alistair McGrath and Professor Jim Al-Khalili. As I said, both of them have websites. You can find out more about Alistair by visiting alistairmcgrath.weebly.com is the website. Also, just search online for his book, Inventing the Universe. Professor Jim Al-Khalili is at jimal-khalili.com. That's jimal-khalili.com. But again, a Google search is your friend as well for both my guests on the programme today. As we start to wrap things up, gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed the conversation we've had today, Jim. Do you get to talk to theologians much? You mentioned Rowan Williams. Do you enjoy these kinds of conversations?
I do, because they do. They keep me on my toes. I mean, scientists can get often very arrogant that we have all the answers, and anyone with a religious faith is just hasn't really thought things through very deeply. And if only I could spend a few minutes pointing things out to them, they slap their forehead and say, "Of course, how could I have been so silly?" And then you talk to a theologian or philosopher and realize we haven't even formulated the questions properly, let alone have all the answers. And I knew I was going to agree mostly with what Alistair said. this was never going to be a big ding-dong.
Sure.
It is. I mean, I find it useful just to... It's certainly not a case of know thine enemy. I mean, it's absolutely, in keeping one intellectual on their toes is good fun.
Alistair, what's your takeaway from today's discussion?
Well, I've greatly enjoyed it. I think our audience will as well. And it just shows that we can have a perfectly sensible discussion about issues of science and faith, which is low on rhetoric and personal aggression and high on intellectual content. I wish other atheists would be as nice as Jim. If I can just say that, Jim, go and tell them, because there's a great conversation to be had here. It's enriching, it's challenging, it's great fun, and people will listen in and enjoy it. And I just think, you know, this has been a model conversation, and I very much hope others will follow.
In the end, Alistair, your view is that when it comes back to this issue of meaning, which is sort of where we started, that making sense of the world does need more than just bare science, in a sense. Science itself will not reveal everything we need to know about what it means
to
be human.
Well, psychologists will tell us that we are meaning-seeking animals. Now, that doesn't make it right, you know, but it does mean that if we are truly to be human, we're going to ask those deep questions, we're going to look for deep answers. And that's why, as a Christian humanist, in that rich sense of the word, you know, I think we're going to keep asking those questions. That's why the subtitle of the book is so important, Why We Can't Stop Talking About Science, Faith and God. That's the way we are.
Yeah.
We can't close these conversations down because they're important, they matter, and hey, they're interesting as well.
As president of the British Humanist Association, Jim, do you think we're going to stop talking? We may not stop talking about science. Do you think we're going to stop talking about faith in God, or do you think it's going to be around?
I think it's pretty much going to be around, whether some of my atheist colleagues like it or not. I mean, as Alistair says, you know, as human beings, we are programmed to seek meaning. Whether there is a higher meaning, a purpose to the universe, no one knows the answer. Some believe there is, some believe there don't, but I mean, there isn't. But I hope we don't stop talking. I hope that's what makes humans so fascinating and rich. And I think this polarization into I'm right and you're wrong is well, we know how much trouble it's getting us into around the world. Why can't the other 7 billion people have this chat that Alistair and
yes.
I've just been having?
Well, absolutely. We may not have room in the studio, but it's been great having you on. Thank you so much, Jim. Lovely to talk to you. And I do hope that if you're listening, you'll check out Jim's stuff as well after today's podcast. Jamal-Khalili.com. Links, though, from the website and to Alistair as well, alistairmcgrath.weebly.com, and links to the book from there as well. Thanks, gentlemen, both, for being with me on the programme today, and I hope to see you again at some point in the future.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, once again, if you'd like to get in touch about anything you've heard on today's programme, put your two pennies worth in, then just email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or indeed find us on Facebook, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, @unbelievablejb for the Twitter account. All of those links and more available from the Unbelievable webpage at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can also leave a comment underneath the latest edition of the programme. Quite a lively comment section often springs up underneath each edition of the programme, so why not pitch in there as well if you'd like to. Thanks to the people who get in touch on a regular basis to say they've just discovered the programme and that they've started downloading it and listening to it. It's always lovely to hear your comments and your input as well. Lots of people send me their ideas for guests and topics and debates and so on. Just before we go to some of your feedback, though, to last week's programme on the Mormon Church, I'd like to give you a very brief whistle-stop tour through the magazine that I edit, Premier Christianity Magazine. What I'm going to play is actually the audio from a recent video that we put up online, and just gives you a sense of the 50-year history of the magazine, where it came from and where we are now. I'd like to take you back in time to a time when trousers were flared, skirts were mini, and a young Welsh singer called Tom Jones had recently had a number one chart hit called It's Not Unusual. The date was October 1965, and a brand new publication called Buzz was about to come into existence, aimed at hip, young Christians who loved pop music and Jesus. What started as a few sheets of folded foolscap paper quickly developed into a fun, irreverent, and vibrant magazine that charted not only the way modern music was impacting the Christian church, but how the church could respond to art, film, youth culture, sex, politics, science, sport, education, fashion, and pretty much everything else in between. For 23 years, Buzz was the essential guide to putting church, faith, and life together, and along the way managed to get a group of Siberian Christians released from Soviet Russia and founded a little Christian festival called Spring Harvest. As the magazine continued to grow up, it had a few facelifts along the way, becoming the rather seriously titled 21st Century Christian before rebranding as Alpha when it charted the arrival of the Toronto Blessing on UK shores and hopes of charismatic revival through the early 90s.
It also managed to cause some controversy by claiming the Disney film Aladdin was sexist, racist, and misogynistic. By the late 90s, the name had become simply Christianity, which it would retain through various incarnations as Christianity in Renewal and Premier Christianity Today. Throughout the new millennium, the mag continued to keep its finger pressed firmly to the beating pulse of culture. From 9/11 and the Da Vinci Code to internet dating and the problem of porn, we've reported it all. And within the church, from Mark Driscoll's masculinity to Steve Chalk's controversies, we've kept you up to date with the latest trends. In 50 years, the fashions, hairdos, and rainbow-strapped guitars may have changed, but today, Premier Christianity still holds that original vision to make faith in Jesus relevant to ordinary people in everyday life. The magazine team have had great fun trawling through 50 years of archive material to create our beautiful, golden 50th anniversary edition. I hope you'll request a copy and read the story for yourself, as well as all the usual great news, reviews, interviews and features. You can even get 50 free copies for your church, and what's more, until the end of October, we're slashing 50% off the cost of subscribing to the magazine. See what we did there? Anyway, just follow the links at premierchristianity.com/50. For now, thanks for watching and see you again in half a century.
Feel free to go online, premierchristianity.com, if you want to watch the video and see what I had to say there. You can subscribe for half the price, half the usual price, until the end of October. So if you've ever thought about subscribing to the magazine, perhaps you've listened to the podcast, the radio show, and you thought, oh, yeah, it sounds quite interesting. This is the month to do it. You will be able to subscribe for 50% off in this month, just until the end of October. So go and find out more about that at premierchristianity.com/50. Thanks to David, who got in touch both via email and actually left this comment, I think, at the programme last week. He was emailing in about the debate on grace between Bill McKeever, who is our Christian, who engages with Mormons, and our Mormon guest, James Holt. He says, either James is being somewhat dishonest about the Mormon church's position on the nature of grace, or he's unfamiliar with the history of this church. I was born in 1967, was born and raised in the Mormon faith. I served a mission to Canada in 1987, and I married my wife in the Mormon temple. Both of my children were born in the covenant. I've since left the Mormon Church, although my name will still be on their books. I left because I believe it to be a fraudulent organization and their exclusive truth claims a sham. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, the emphasis within the church was very much based on effort and our works and our ability to earn our salvation. Grace was acknowledged half-heartedly, almost begrudgingly, and was largely disregarded. The task of salvation was impossible. We were taught to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. Clearly, the intent of the church was to keep a workforce that would run the church for free. However, thanks to Google, which revealed the real truths of Mormonism, many people, including myself, woke up and simply walked away. The church is now trying to backpedal and make Mormon theology seem more appealing and more in line with the mainstream. The result is the mixed messages and confusing rhetoric that become an increasing feature of living as a Mormon. Within Mormonism, there's always been a clash between private practice and public proclamation. Mormons will tell you one thing and practice something else. I think we saw something of this coming from James Holt. The Mormon Church will completely change its doctrine, but will then insist that was how it was all along. This is an old joke. How many Mormons does it take to change a light bulb? Two. One to change the bulb, and the second person to say that nothing's changed. This is pretty much how the Mormon Church operates, and James demonstrated it. I normally wouldn't have a problem with the church changing policy, but the problem with Mormonism is that it teaches that the Mormon Church is the one and only true church on earth, and the doctrines of the church are completely true. This becomes a problem, of course, when the teachings constantly change. Keep up the good work. I look forward to your show every week. If you have any good ideas how I can navigate my faith into a proper Christian church, I would be grateful. I'm finding it hard to get my head around what I actually believe since leaving the Mormon Church. Well, I wouldn't feel that I was in a position to direct you towards a particular church, Dave, but there are many good churches out there. I guess it's just a case of really looking for yourself at what feels like it might be a good home for you, you know, both in terms of the doctrine and the nature, the churchmanship there. So perhaps you've got a suggestion for where Dave could try. I'm not even sure where you live, Dave, so it would be hard for me to exactly give you a suggestion. But thank you very much for getting in touch. Really interesting story. Having lived in Salt Lake and been trained in a Baptistic seminary, says Steve Johnson on Facebook. I found this one more personally interesting than most. However, I wish Mr. McKeever could have responded to Mr. Holt a bit more. Mr. McKeever too often ignored Holt's representation of his faith to work towards convincing him and the listener how wrong Mormonism is. Honestly, from what I heard, Holt is one who could be an asset in the LDS circles. I guess I don't believe that we need to save people from Mormonism. Rather, we would be wise to see how Christ can redeem that wayward sect. I recall something along those lines happening in the Worldwide Church of God about the time I was in seminary in the late 1990s. David Jones says the Jesus of Mormonism is not the Jesus of the New Testament. So my question is, how can the Jesus of Mormonism be the same as the Jesus of the New Testament? Also, what is the relationship of Jesus and Lucifer? If the answer is that they are celestial brothers, then Jesus is not Emmanuel, God with us, as only God can save us. That's what my Bible teaches. The issue is that the grace that Mormons have is a false grace, and therefore, as St. Paul warns, a false gospel. Stephen Paul, via Facebook, says another great program this week. Really interesting to hear the different perspectives regarding the doctrine of grace. My only wish is that James Holt had spent a bit more time describing his definition and the doctrinal grounding for it. I got the impression that his view on grace has developed with time as he contrasted his current viewpoint from the one Bill McKeever brought up using Mormon doctrine. Perhaps I misunderstood, but I didn't seem to hear his support for his evolved view. As a Christian, much of my understanding of grace arises from the New Testament, especially the Book of Romans. It would have been interesting to hear Mr. Holt compare the Mormon texts raised by Mr. McKeever, as such as in the Doctrines and Covenants, to passages in the Bible on grace, such as Romans 3:21-27. Additionally, I had trouble with the idea proposed by Mr. Holt that grace is first received and then commands are followed as evidence of grace. His description seemed to highlight what Mr. McKeever was bringing up about a Mormon trying to prove oneself worthy. If one has to pay something back or live it out to receive it, then it's not a gift. It seems more like a down payment or wage. It's something earned, and that seems to defeat the purpose of grace. As Christians, I believe that we don't earn anything. If we tried, we'd only earn death. And I would argue that when we receive grace, we do indeed do what we want, because Christ comes in, changes our hearts, and our desires change to meet his. Grace leads us to loving God. As the paraphrase of St. Augustine goes, love God and do whatever you please, for the soul trained in love to God will do nothing to offend the one who is beloved. Just my two cents. Thank you, Stephen. Over at the Unbelievable page and under the programme there, a couple of people got in touch. Peter Ratcliffe left his thoughts underneath the show to say the Mormon doctrine of God being a man from a planet called Kolob, becoming a god after sex, and then of people doing the same and becoming gods with their own planets would indeed require huge, huge amounts of grace. Even more so, it requires even more vast quantities of gullibility. Mormons need the real Jesus, who isn't the spirit brother of Satan, if they're to be saved. The best place for that is in rejecting the Book of Mormon and the LDS cult and turning to the God of the Bible in a true and serious evangelical church. And David says, do Mormons believe in grace? The question is rather odd when removed from the paradigm of the LDS church framework, its origin, time of origin, and historic belief system. America has the unique status of being the cultural womb which birthed some of the largest 19th century alternatives to conventional Christianity. They not only maintained a large following, but grew rapidly to become worldwide, influential, and financially prosperous groups. During this formative period, traditional denominations up and down the American Eastern Seaboard were experienced charismatic gifts of the Spirit, including speaking in tongues with interpretation and prophecy, decades before the Azusa Street revival. The Methodist Church in the New England state started to rethink the doctrines of eternal conscious hell, and many congregations adopted annihilationism. Their open-air revival meetings abounded with highly spirited singing and a new style of emotionally charged preaching, the Woodstock of pioneer America. The SDA Church preached for several years under the prophetic guidance of Ellen G. Harmon White that the door of salvation had closed forever in 1844, until they changed their minds under prophetic guidance and began proselytizing fast and furiously, still believing that the Second Advent was, in some instances, only months away. By mid-century, the Fox Sisters had started the mad craze of spiritualism, with an estimated 800,000 to 1 million adherents. The way had been paved with liberal doses of lubricating oil for radical change, and the Great Awakening of the 1740s was beginning to look quite tame. All of the ingredients were there. Someone just needed to mix the right cocktails, and they did. Although an obsession with religion began much earlier in American culture with regrettable outcomes, the 19th century gave birth to the Mormons, The Millerites, 100,000 strong, believing in the literal return of Jesus in 1843 and 1844. Millerite followers who redefined the 1844 Second Coming and became the Seventh-day Adventist Church. American spiritualism inspired by the Fox Sisters and their mysterious rapping. Christian Science and Jehovah's Witnesses. The commonalities among these large groups, partially accepting the early Millerites, include either a gifted or a prophetic leader, fanatical devotion to the leader, special or sacred documents which must be read alongside the scripture or above scripture in order to interpret or change its meaning as needed, and an extremely authoritarian leadership. Considering that the LDS Church is just one in this grouping of large religious movements, but solely from American pioneer popular culture, the question, do they believe in grace, seems to be irrelevant when divorced from this setting. Thank you very much. That was quite a long explanation, and sorry I had to cut it down a bit, David, of the cradle, as you say, within which Mormonism arose. Thanks for those responses to that interesting debate last week on whether Mormons believe in grace. We've also had some other interesting debates of a scientific nature. Homo naledi, the new find out in South Africa, and its implications for beliefs in creation and evolution and humanity and so on. Now, apologies to Victor, who got in touch to say, I like how you sort of announced my mail in advance in the last show, but it also revealed that despite the huge wall of text I sent you, I haven't succeeded in conveying my main point. So here's what Victor wanted to say. The DNA evidence indeed suggests that all the species originated from a universal common ancestor, but, and it's a tremendous but, DNA evidence also suggests that this universal common ancestor was not a simple bacterium like a prokaryote, as Darwinists traditionally envision it, but a primordial stem cell with a large complex genome which stored all the information for the whole process of evolution and terraformation. This is an analogous process to the development of a human from a single cell, the fertilized female egg. This is how biology works in reality, says Victor. Victor, you can look forward to a debate on intelligent design coming up in a couple of weeks' time, so look out for that. Here's Paul Smith, who said, thank you very much for the show. I regularly listen in Melbourne, Australia. You ask about conference DVDs, wanting to purchase the DVD of Unbelievable Conference from last year. Easy to do that, Paul. All you do is go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD, and they're still available. You can order one there. You also ask about offering balancing views. You say, in your recent show on Homo Naledi, I appreciated listening to James Kidder from Biologos, for whom I haven't heard much over recent years. I heard you express a wish to include the young earth creation view. As I understood your comment, it would have made the show too complex or taken it in a different direction. Well, I'm comfortable with that, but find it curious why the young earth or 6-day creation view creates a considerable amount of heat in vigorous conversations. Richard Dawkins, in an Australian Broadcasting Commission's Q&A TV panel discussion program, made a comment about feeling some sympathy with 6-day creationists versus bishops accommodating evolution views. Only within the first 3 minutes, Dawkins comments he thought the writing was on the wall for bishops and for clergy who want to sit on the fence of evolution and God's creation. I'm not here to argue one way or the other. I do find it helpful to be exposed to constructive, logical, evidentially based reasons for differing viewpoints. While 6-day creationism, young earth views are often controversial, could we please include these views for balance? Having qualified, well-researched speakers with doctorates in their field is very informative, especially when put up against a differing angle of understanding. I've been reading a few articles from Truth in Science. Dr. Andy McIntosh has spoken here in the UK. Yeah, I wasn't at all saying I was not going to allow a young earth creation voice on that particular debate at some point. I'm sure we could arrange that, Paul, only that I felt in the context of that discussion it would have, I don't know, broken the conversation too far wide in all sorts of different directions to us to be able to kind of really keep the thread. Well, time for one more email. This comes from Mark Parrott, who writes, I'm writing to express my surprise at the recent findings of a poll conducted by the Evangelical Alliance that you cited on a recent Unbelievable show. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you said 40% of those surveyed doubted the existence of Jesus. I freely admit there is widespread ignorance as to the true person of Jesus, but these findings don't tally with my own extensive surveying, whereby I approach people on the streets of my city, Chelmsford, on a weekly basis, seeking to engage in conversation with them. As you can see, very few actually believe that Jesus didn't exist, and of those, I don't think any have given the mythicist argument or are even aware of it. Well, you're right, Mark, that was the figure I gave. In fact, it was 39%, but, you know, good as 40%, in this survey by Barna Research for the Evangelical Alliance and the Church of England. So a reputable surveying organisation, and they came up with this figure from a joint figure of about 22%, I think, who said they believed Jesus was a mythical figure, and a further, I guess, 17% who were unsure of the existence of Jesus. That gives you 39%, and it did seem high to me. I'm not quite sure I could swallow that, that really nearly 40% of people doubt the existence of Jesus. And you give your results here, your Street Apologetics survey. Question one, how do you believe the world began? And 46%. Responded created by God, 25% evolved by chance, not sure was 29%. Question two, you asked, do you believe there is an ultimate meaning or purpose to life? Yes, said 64%. No, said 17%. Not sure, 19%. How do you seek to live your life? By the teaching of the Bible, 17%. By your own moral code, 38%. A combination of the above, 40%. By another moral code, e.g. the Quran, 5%. What do you believe happens when you die? Heaven or hell, 35%, reincarnation, 9%, nothing, 23%, not sure, 33%. And finally, what do you believe about Jesus? I don't believe Jesus existed, only 4%. I believe he existed, but stories of his life have been exaggerated, 28%. I believe he was just a good moral teacher, a prophet, but no more than that, 32%. And I believe he was the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, 36%. There you go. So, yes, clearly a big difference between your survey on the streets of Chelmsford and this national survey by Barna for the Evangelical Alliance. But thank you. Interesting reading, and appreciated you getting in touch. Thanks to all who have been in touch. No time for any more at the moment. But if you want to send in any thoughts about today's programme and some of the feedback we've read out as well, be interested to hear from you. You can email unbelievable@premier.org. Well, coming up next here on Faith Explored, you can hear The Profile. We'll be hearing about the Connor Project and Loretta talking to Simon May, the composer, as it happens, of the EastEnders theme tune, about his life and faith. But if you're coming back same time next week or via the podcast, let me tell you what's happening then.
You're unbelievable.
We're revisiting the resurrection in a show that should have been broadcast actually a couple of weeks ago, but which for technical reasons was not able to be broadcast. We've re-recorded, and we're pleased to have Ed Atkinson coming in, and he's going to be in discussion with Tony Costa. Tony is a Canadian apologist. They're going to be debating the evidence for the resurrection, the minimal facts, and that was something that was debated between Gary Habermas and James Crossley during the summer. Well, Ed was very interested and wanted to ask some questions, grill someone who takes that same approach. And so that's what we'll be hearing at the same time next week. Hope you can come back for that as well. For the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking, Unbelievable. I'll see you next week.